This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of January 17th, 2022, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. If you've lived around here for a while, you know the name Crystal DeHaan, one of the great success stories in modern Indianapolis history. And her impact on the city as a philanthropist can't be overstated. She was a bedrock contributor to arts and culture organizations, and there are four schools that bear her name in Indianapolis, which are part of Crystal House International. She founded the education not-for-profit in 1998 to uplift children who live in poverty around the world and give them the tools to realize their potential. Crystal House currently serves more than 6,000 students and alumni through nine schools located in India, Jamaica, Mexico, South Africa, and the United States. Crystal DeHaan was the co-founder of Resort Condominiums International, a timeshare exchange company which she sold in 1996 for $825 million, making her one of the richest women in the United States. In 2007, she finished work on a breathtaking estate with a 41,000 square foot home with a private lake on a 150 acre property in near North Indianapolis. She called it Linden House, after the tree that's popular in her home country of Germany. It's round about 45th and Michigan Road, just northeast of the Newfields campus, although it's kind of tough to see from the road. She lived there until her death in 2020 at the age of 77. It hit the market 2 weeks ago with a listing price of $14 million. And as stipulated by Crystal DeHaan, the proceeds from the sale will go to Crystal House International, establishing an endowment to help it expand its operations. Now, this is an incredibly rare opportunity for those with the means to own a huge piece of land in Washington Township and a relatively new 61-room mansion. When we look at the few similar properties that have been on the market in central Indiana since 2000, history suggests that it could take years for this to sell. The easiest comparison would be to the Asherwood Estate in Carmel, formerly owned by Mel Simon, which after several years on the market was sold in two pieces, the 50,000 square foot mansion and adjacent land to a private buyer, and the remaining 87 acres to a residential real estate developer. Now, on this week's podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the history of Linden House and Crystal DeHaan's vision for the property. We'll hear how the sale process is going so far, and we'll learn more about its intended legacy as a financial driver for Crystal House International. Our guests are listing agent Mike Johnson, Mark Willis, the DeHaan family's representative in the sale, and Bart Peterson, former mayor of Indianapolis and current CEO of Crystal House International. Here's our conversation. I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast three guests this week. Let's have you guys say hi. I want to introduce you so our listeners can get a bead on your voices. First, we have Bart Peterson, the CEO of Crystal House International, and of course, a former mayor of Indianapolis. Bart, thanks for coming.
Hi, Mason. It's nice to be here. Thank you for having us.
Sure. Now, Mark Willis is the president and chief investment officer of CD Enterprises, which is the DeHaan family office. Hello, Mark.
Morning, Mason. Nice to meet you and glad to be here.
And Mike Johnson is the Sotheby's International Realty agent who is handling the listing. And we also should say that it is co-listed by Stan Burton of Avison Young. Mike, thanks for taking time.
Good morning, Mason. Thank you very much.
Well, great. Well, this is a fascinating story. Obviously, there's a large real estate component, but it's also the key to one of the city's most respected education not-for-profits, being able to expand on its work. Who would like to start us off, though, with the story of Crystal DeHaan deciding to build this house? What was the vision here?
Well, I might take a stab at that, Mason, and then let Mike jump in, too. Crystal wanted a place in Indianapolis that would be a place she could retreat to from all of her other responsibilities as the chairman and head of Crystal House International. As it was growing, all of her philanthropic activities around the city of Indianapolis and the board positions she sat on. But more than a retreat, she really wanted a place to be able to entertain and host guests really from all over the world, but also do fundraising for other nonprofits. There was some fundraising activity there for Crystal House International, but she also entertained and did fundraising for other nonprofits. So this particular property, when it became available, was very well suited for what she was interested in. I always describe Linden House, which is the property where her home sits, as kind of her second passion. Crystal House International, the kids that it serves, the families, that was always her main passion. And she devoted hours and hours and years and days and to that mission. But Linden House is really her second passion. And the landscaping and the art around the property was something she really, really did personally enjoy developing over the course of her time in building the property as well as living there.
Yeah, Mike, this must have been a super fun listing to write. I mean, how often do you get this much stuff to write about? What really stands out for you?
Oh, gosh, this has really been an opportunity of my career so far. You know, properties like this, by and large, aren't available in Indiana. For that matter, properties like this aren't available throughout the country that often. You know, the house has so many incredible features, but what stands out to me every time I'm there more than anything is it's two things. It's the setting and the location itself. The fact that you've got this magnificent home that sits on 150 acres, 10 minutes from downtown Indianapolis, is pretty unique. But as you move through the gates, you're really transported into someplace quite different. As you move through the gates, you get a glimpse of this 35-acre private lake, and you move towards the house. And because of the location next to White River and next to this lake, you have an abundance of wildlife and waterfowl. And that income in combination with the formal and informal gardens, it really makes for a unique experience.
Now, Bart, you probably were there several times. What is the effect as a visitor to this house of coming up that road, entering the house, and how adequate was it for fundraising?
It was reasonably adequate. I went to, you know, a number of gatherings there, events over the years that Crystal hosted. But when I came on as a full-time employee of Crystal House International, Crystal retired as the CEO. She remained the board chair of the organization, but she retired as CEO. And I took on that role. I came to meet with her once a week. And so there was a little sort of a shortcut. You could come up the side to get to the house, but I always went the long way because I just wanted to take that in. I never got tired of it. It kind of reminded me, I spent a number of years working for the governor in the state house. And every day I walked into the state house, I said, I'm really lucky to be able to work in this place. It's a beautiful, historic place. Well, you know, once a week I got to go to Linden House and meet with Crystal, and both the experience of meeting with Crystal and also the experience of this home. And as Mike said, the incredible setting and the care that she put into literally every detail across that 150 acres is unparalleled. If there's a prettier house in the United States, I don't know what it would be.
Now, Mark, what was on this land before?
There was a monastery on the property, and this was came available for sale back. Mike, was that in the early 2000s?
My recollection is I think she purchased the property maybe 1999, something okay. like that. Yeah. And then the house was started in 2003, and it took 4 years to build the house. And she moved in 2007.
You know, the design of that house, I kind of struggled when I was writing an online item about it to describe it. Mark, do you have a sense of kind of what she was going for? I mean, there sometimes when I look at the pictures and I think, you know, Italian vineyard, other times it feels quite a bit more American. Do you ever have a sense of what she was going for?
Yeah, really kind of a combination of the two, you know, the Italian aspect, but then also some influence from United States. I believe it's called Palladium. Is that right, Mike?
Yeah,
architectural style.
Yes, it's Palladian architecture, and it was influenced by Via La Rotonda, which is in northern Italy, and also Jefferson's Monticello. Oh. It's simple architecture. It's where rooms within the house are similar in size and similar proportions, I guess, is a better description than size. But it's simple, relatively unadorned architecture, which really provides a backdrop for what Linden House is, which is, interestingly enough, it's a combination of, as far as the interior goes, antiques and some modern pieces of furniture and classic art and modern art. It's really beautiful architecture that sets the stage for the interior that Linden House has, which is pretty amazing.
Let me make sure I understand what's for sale here. It is both the house and the grounds, and that's all together 150 acres or so?
Correct.
And you're offering them together?
Correct.
Do you want to make sure that the buyer intends to use it as a residence, or would you be willing to sell the whole shebang to a developer?
I don't see it being anything other than a single family residence. And since we went live with the listing last Monday, we have had fantastic response. So far, all of the potential buyers that have looked at it have been looking at it as a single family residence.
Can you give me an idea of where these buyers are coming from? Are they all local or?
So far, everybody is local. I did have a conversation yesterday with a couple from California that are intending to fly here possibly today or tomorrow to take a look at it. And then 2 days ago, I had a conversation with a gentleman from Germany about the property. It's hard to say where it's going to lead, but we're starting to get traction outside of Indianapolis. But so far, it's been local buyers.
Now, there's a good deal of art and furniture that I saw in the pictures of the listing. Is that included, or will those be sold separately, or is that just an amazing job of staging the house?
It is not staged. That is existing furniture and art, but the property is being sold excluding the art and furniture.
However, the art and furniture is available to a buyer. I mean, it's the way it's put together, it's hard to imagine someone starting over from scratch to furnish in that home. I suppose it's possible, but it certainly would be a task. And it's so beautiful the way it is. But as Mike described, we have the home for sale with the acreage. Art and furnishings are available also for purchase.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 625 attorneys across 11 offices, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We'll continue our conversation with Mike Johnson, Mark Willis, and Bart Peterson about Linden House and Crystal House International.
How do you price something like this? How do you come to an asking price of $14 million?
I'll tell you, it's not an easy process. If we're in New York or California or other parts of the country, it's a simpler process because you have a lot more past sales to use as comparable properties. This property really has nothing that is comparable. The most comparable property would likely be Asherwood, which was the Simon Estate in Carmel, or the Hilbert Estate in Carmel, which is also in Carmel. But in my personal opinion, I don't think either of those properties compare to this property. Simon's property would likely be the most comparable in size and scale, but I believe this property is a superior property and its location is more unique in that you can be to any place in the city within 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah, why did she want to establish a residence what is still basically the heart of Indianapolis? I mean, you're a stone's throw away from the art museum. when, I mean, there are so many options that she could have taken in the suburbs.
Really, a lot of her activity was centered in the downtown business district. I mean, she had a business office that we continue to operate out of for Crystal House International and her family foundation. And she wanted to be close to downtown. I mean, she spent a lot of time downtown on business, but also on pleasure, enjoying the arts that are presented in many venues around downtown Indianapolis. And the convenience to the airport, the art museum, and then the property itself was unique in terms of being that close and adjacent to downtown. It was very, very convenient versus, you know, driving to the far north side or far south side or something like that.
Now, Mike, you brought up Asherwood, which the Mel Simon estate at 96 and Ditch. That had a 51,000 square foot house and about 100 acres of land.
Correct.
The Hilbert Mansion was, I think, 25,000 square feet on 33 acres of land at Carmel. I'm going to throw in Scott Jones's mansion, which was about 24,000 square feet in Carmel. I don't know what the land was. The common thread in all three of those was that it took a long time to sell those houses. Asherwood took, I think, from the point it was originally listed to when it sold, and that's a whole long story, but it's 7 years. I think Scott Jones's house was 3 years. The Hilbert Mansion was probably, 5 years.
Right.
I mean, that's a long lead time. Are you guys prepared to wait that long?
I quite honestly, I don't think we're going to have to wait that long. I think that this property stands out in terms of location and quality above those three properties. And I think that's in part why we have had such an incredible response to it. Every inch of this property is in perfect condition. Every hedge is beautifully trimmed. There's not a weed any place on the property. And it's a property where you can walk in the front door, and if you didn't buy the furniture and art, or even if you just had other furniture of your own that you were going to use, you move it in place and it's ready to go. There are no renovations that need to be made. It's quite a unique property.
And then one of the other common threads is, I don't think that we were privy to how much Asherwood sold for, but we know that the house sold separate from the land, which went to a developer. But both the Hilbert house and the Jones house, I think they went for quite a bit less than what they originally were asking. Is there a floor for what you guys are willing to accept?
I think when all is said and done, it will not surprise me if this property sells over list price.
Is that because of how kind of nutso the market is, or do you think it's really just the quality of the property?
It's the quality of the property. When you come in, as you walk through the home, you have things like solid mahogany and doors throughout the house. You have mahogany floors throughout the house. Everywhere you look, whether you are looking down a hallway, you have a view of a beautiful piece of art, or you look in any direction and you're looking out these beautiful mahogany doors and windows and you see the lake and you see the river and you see the gardens. That's quite different. I was in the Asherwood estate. I was in the Hilbert estate. I was in Scott Jones's estate. And this is a different type of property.
You know, a question just occurred to me. So we have three guys here. Who decides when to sell the house?
Well, that more or less drops to me. and timing is really driven, has been driven really by the estate settlement process. And we're at the point where we were able to list the property and move it forward. According to Crystal's wishes, she wanted the property sold and the proceeds maximized as much as possible so that those proceeds will be combined with other assets to continue to support Crystal House International and the kids and the families that it serves. And Crystal House has a very interesting strategic planning process going on right now in order to figure out new ways and current ways of continuing to serve more kids. So we serve over 6,600 kids around the world today. And Bart can talk more about this, but they really are pushing to find ways to open more schools and serve more kids in a variety of ways, because we know the Crystal House model works. So,
sure. Yeah, Bart, now my understanding is that the proceeds from this sale and some other things would establish an endowment. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So among Crystal's many incredible gifts to Crystal House, including other parts of her legacy after she passed away in 2020, she intended for this house and the proceeds from its sale to go to Crystal House International to support our expansion. And this is something that she and I and the rest of our staff and our board talked about quite a lot, about the importance of getting the Crystal House model that, as Mark said, is proven effective over now 24 years. It's been 24 years since she founded Crystal House. It's been proven effective. We want to bring it to more kids. We feel, our team feels a moral imperative to help expand the availability of the Crystal House model to more kids, because we knew that's what Crystal's vision was.
So where would you be looking to expand, and how many more students would you be able to serve?
Well, we have five international schools right now. I could certainly imagine that being doubled in a relatively few years. So less than a decade from now, I would expect to see twice as many Crystal House schools outside of the United States. That's really where our focus mostly is. We would potentially seek opportunities inside the United States, including in, here in Indianapolis. But our main focus on expansion is outside of the U.S. And we are currently in India, where we have two schools, South Africa, where we have a school in Cape Town, Mexico City, and then our newest school is in Jamaica. And every one of those countries is interested in seeing us expand there. And then there are some other countries that we'll be looking at as well that are not currently places where we have schools. So this is part of our planning process that we're in the midst of right now, but we're also moving forward at the same time that we're planning. For example, our Mexico City team has been gearing up for expansion for the last couple of years, and so we've really shifted that into high gear now. I would think it's very likely the next Crystal House you'll see will be in Mexico.
Do you necessarily need to have this house sell in order to be able to move forward?
It's not essential for everything we need to do, but it is certainly part of our expansion planning. The proceeds from this will be very meaningful for our ability to move forward at an accelerated pace.
Yeah. Just at the moment, you don't know exactly what it would sell for, so it's hard to imagine.
No, but I'm taking Mike at its word that it's going to sell very well.
My feet are being held to the fire.
Okay. Hey, do me a favor, Bart, for folks who aren't familiar with Crystal House International, just briefly outline what is unique about that model.
Yeah, so Crystal believed, she traveled all over the world when she ran her company, RCI, and not only did she see condominium resorts and other places where middle class and upper middle class and very well-to-do people lived, she also saw the poverty that often was adjacent to the places that she visited. And her eyes were wide open and her heart was open. And she wanted, after she sold the business and became a very wealthy woman, she wanted to devote herself to giving the young people who came from really the bottom of the economic ladder around the world in the places where she had done business, an opportunity to, as she put it, have a seat at the table of life. She believed that that was about education, first and foremost. I think we would all agree on that, that without an opportunity for a high quality education, the chances for success in life are pretty limited. But she saw it as much more than just education. So that's why we always say that Crystal House is more than just a school or a series of schools, because she believed that you had to accompany a rigorous education program with character education, with life skills training, with healthcare. So we provide healthcare to the students and their families. We provide nutrition. She believed that no student could learn effectively on an empty stomach, so that children get two full meals a day and a nutritious snack before they leave in the afternoon. She believed that we had to include families to lift up the entire family. And then finally, probably the most unique part of the Crystal House model is the college and careers program. So we stick with the students for 5 years after they graduate from high school. There are a lot of great schools around the world, that many of which serve students from similar backgrounds to those that we serve. But the typical model is you shake hands with the students and hand them their diploma at the age of 18. And that's the last you see of them until they come back to visit and say hi. We are sticking with them. We have a formal program that sticks with them for 5 years to help see them through a four-year college or university program, if that's what they choose to do. And the majority of our students do, but not all of them. We support them just as much if they choose to go into a vocation or right into the workforce after high school. And then, the idea is that we'll stick with them through that first year in the workforce as well if they do finish a four-year degree.
Now, when the founder of an organization passes away, it can be a pretty traumatic event for the organization, and it could be time for reevaluating this direction. And I assume, the big question that people ask themselves as well, where do we go from here? So in the last 18 months, how have you been able to set the future course for Crystal House? Was the roadmap so clear that you really didn't need to second guess anything?
Well, I would say yes and no. The yes part is that Crystal was very clear and spent a lot of time not only putting this in writing, but also talking to all of us associated with Crystal House about, what her intentions were, what she wanted. And she sort of laid out certain non-negotiables. But she also, the flip side is, she also was very clear that organizations have to evolve and grow and innovate. And she did, she put this very bluntly. She said, I don't want to rule from the grave. She said, when I'm gone, you're going to have to do some things differently. I want you to do things differently while I'm still alive. And she wanted to see innovation and growth.
Am I right in understanding Crystal funded personally the overhead and fundraising for the organization? Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And she put us in a position where we could tell all donors that anything they contributed would go directly to educating kids.
So now that she's gone, is there a mechanism in place to continue funding those things that she personally was funding?
Yeah, I'll let Mark talk about that. But the answer is yes.
Yeah, to Crystal's credit, she did an amazing amount of very thoughtful estate planning. And to that point, she did pledge during her lifetime and after that she would fund general administrative operating expenses, fundraising expenses, and any fundraising shortfalls so that donor dollars, when corporations or individuals give money to Crystal House, it goes directly to the kids and the families and makes a difference in the lives of those folks. So we have, through all that planning, just a new process. Instead of Crystal making those grants and gifts to Crystal House during her lifetime, she set all the appropriate things up in place that will continue to happen after her lifetime.
Well, I've taken a lot of your time. Mark, I've got one more question for you. As the decider on selling the house, does it matter to you who you sell it to or what they plan to do with the property?
First of all, I'm not the total decider. We actually have a board of directors that is involved in that decision. So, and thank goodness, because I don't want that entire responsibility myself. But we'd love to see it used as a single family home for a family to really enjoy. Crystal loved the property and enjoyed it. We'd love to see a similar family situation at the end of the day. However, Crystal knew and that there was always the potential the property could be used for something that we never thought of. And she and I had a lot of discussions about how the property might be used, in the future and what it might be used for. And we thought strategically often about how to position it so that it could be maximized in some form. And at the end of the day, we're really interested in getting as much for the property as possible. And that's what Crystal wanted, so that those assets can be used to support Crystal House.
So you potentially could have an Asherwood scenario where somebody has the house, but some of the acreage could be developed by a residential developer, potentially.
That is a potential option, yes, that you could see that outcome.
Well, guys, thank you so much for making the time and doing such a great job sharing responsibilities of speaking. That was probably the smoothest podcast ever.
Thank you, Mason.
Thank you.
My thanks again to Mike Johnson, Mark Willis, and Bart Peterson. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are several stories in the latest edition of IBJ that I want to draw to your attention. First up, Indianapolis leaders want more affordable housing in Marion County for low and mid-income residents, but low-cost options often sunset after a period of years. IBJ's Leslie Bonisia-Muniz reports that city officials and a wide range of neighborhood organizations think they have found an approach that can keep some properties affordable indefinitely, community land trusts. Also in this week's issue, Susan Orr reports on the progress of private equity firm Monument Microcap Partners toward its goal of buying small firms and helping them grow. And Dave Lindquist explains how long delays at vinyl pressing plants are affecting Indiana-based recording artists and music stores who cater to fans of the resurgent vinyl format. You can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. It's a little easier said than done, but I can guarantee you access if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for all of the latest news about local business and politics, plus all of IBJ's data about the Central Indiana economy and corporate community. Just seriously, it's a really good deal. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.